You know, Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland and former head of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, she is an amazing woman. When it was totally unpopular, days after 9/11, she was the only high-profile person that stood with us. If you just write down these words, International Civil Society Statement on the Terror Attacks in the US, something like that. International Civil Society Statement on... You Google that. That was a statement. Civicus took the lead in bringing together international action aid and so on, trade union movement and so on, immediately after 9/11, where we issued a statement to the leaders of the world saying, don't undermine the rule of law, don't act in anger, don't act in revenge, because if you do that, you're going to make it worse. And Mary Robinson said, she stood with us and she said, firstly, calling our response to 9/11 as a war on terror was strategically, tactically, ethically, and I added grammatically flawed, because terrorism is a tactic. How do you wage a war against a tactic, right? And sadly, everything we want, you know, it's the kind of thing where you wish you are wrong, you know, but unfortunately we were right. Everything we want came to pass. That you will drive more people into the arms of the men of terror. You will also, you see, when you call it a war, right, on a war, you give legitimacy, and as Mary used to say, you give juice to the terrorists by calling it a war. We were pushing to say, consider it a crime against humanity and a gross violation of human rights. Because let's face it, there are people that have been dying of bomb blasts around the world for many, many moons, right? Suddenly, it's people of a particular color in a particular country. Then we have to capsize the old world around, you know, and then change the old terms of the current history. So, and sadly, I have to tell you that it has made the work of a movement like Civicus incredibly difficult. Right? I mean, right now, we've got two members in Ethiopia, two of the leaders of the Make Poverty History campaign in Ethiopia that have been in prison for 2 years, 2 months. You know, at the meeting on Friday, I mentioned it, and that evening I said they were going to court, the mothers were going to court to get the verdict. They've pushed the trial again now to Christmas Eve. Anyway, it's a long story. You can visit the Civicus website to find out the whole horror. But what's happening is the Ethiopian government can do that because the U.S. government is totally in cahoots with them because of the situation in Somalia, right? And there's, you know, I've been to the U.S. State Department on behalf of these folks, to the Capitol Congress and so on. They patronize you, say, what great work you're doing, you're such a champion for human rights and so on. And then as you're walking out, you know, they're saying, what a naive guy. How can he expect us to actually do anything to really put pressure? So I think governments need to really just stop and take a stock of the following things. Firstly, you know, security, you know, the way we understand, the way the governments have responded to the notion of security is completely, not only it's unjust, it's naive, and it's actually self-defeating. If you think security is just national security in the way we understand it, where you only think about sort of military, police, surveillance, and so on, you're never going to actually create real security. Because if you don't link that to the notion of human security more broadly, by which you mean, you include all of that stuff, right? But as a friend of mine in Thailand says, you know, a hungry, you know, millions of hungry stomachs are collectively a weapon of mass destruction too. You know, unless you can actually see the insecurity that comes from extreme poverty, homelessness, domestic violence, and a whole range of other things, and try and think about how you actually respond to it in a more nuanced way. So As we stand now, 60 countries in the world have passed so-called counterterrorism or anti-terrorism legislation, which does not balance terrorism concerns with human rights concerns, totally disrespects the rule of law. I was telling a story about Zimbabwe. I don't know whether people know Zimbabwe, unfortunately, is just kind of going down the tubes. No, not for specifically the war on terrorism, but because of a political leader who was a liberation hero who has stayed 15 years more than he should have stayed in power. And but you know, when we go to, because some of them, you know, we used to be in the liberation struggles together, so we have some relationships, and we go to talk to them, they say things like, why are you giving us a hard time? We're not doing Abu Ghraib prison. Everybody knows about Abu Ghraib? Yeah? We didn't do Abu Ghraib prison. You want to talk about real torture and violation of human life and dignity? The Americans did that. We're not running an illegal prison in Guantanamo Bay, which violates the Geneva Convention. We are not like the CIA running these... do you know what extraordinary rendition is? Where they capture people illegally from one country, torture them in another country, and dump them in a third country. The UK government is trying to pass longer detention without trial legislation, racial and religious profiling. And my appeal to whatever advocacy you're doing here in New Zealand, because see, the Solicitor General, I understand, and not dissimilar to your situation here with the anti-terrorism laws, most of them actually technically will have elements of illegality in them. It will violate the Constitution. I mean, your anti-terrorism law, we couldn't pass it in South Africa because it will violate the constitution of our country, because there are very clear protections on everything from privacy to... detention without trial, right? Let me tell you a nice, small, nice anecdote. A Civicus board member from the UK was coming to a Civicus board meeting being held in Johannesburg. And the chair of the board, a woman from India called Aruna Rao, at the beginning of the board meeting, she's just stepped out of the board now, but she had a very nice thing, you know, because people would have traveled all over the world to come. So she says, let's spend the first hour just talking about our lives. You know, did you have a grandchild? Did you get divorced? Did you, you know, have an affair? Did you, you know? So people go around and they say things. You know, personal and professional things. And, the British board member said, this was about 2 years ago, he said, last night I left a country called the United Kingdom, which just passed a 28-day detention without trial law, which follows legislation that allows for house arrest, that does racial and religious profiling, and so on. Today morning I landed in a country called South Africa that 10 years ago said, never again to house arrest, never again to detention without trial, never again to racism and any other kind of profiling. And I can give you a personal story. I was on a plane from Atlanta to Washington on my way to Eastern Europe after 9/11, and got on the plane. I was traveling economy, but I was on United Airlines, where I was on the super duper frequent flyer. So I got bumped up to the first row, seat 1C. I sit down there very happy and thrilled with this upgrade. And then they close the doors, and suddenly there's like knocks on the door. Now, I got searched 3 times more than everybody else coming onto the plane. Right? And then I'll tell you the story, because I'll just tell you how it plays out in the public debate. Right? And to cut a long story short, 4 U.S. Marshals came onto the plane, whispered to the chief stewardess, and then she came to me and said, sir, if you don't mind, get all your documents and your belongings, and you have to come out. So I go out and say, what's happening? They say they want to search you. I said, you've searched me 3 times. How much more do you want to search me? So then they made me... And this was before... You know that British guy... what's his name? Richard Reed or something. the shoe bomber. This was before. This was before that incident when they went asking people to take out shoes. And so they're me. I'm in Atlanta airport. They asked me to take out my shoe, and to my horror, I discover I've got a hole in both my socks. I'm in the middle of the airport being searched. I'm more worried about my hole in my socks. Anyway, they searched me half an hour, and they held the plane up because I was like I was based in the US at that time, and I was, you know, for my job, I have to travel a lot, and I'm one of the sort of most. So 2 years later, I am on a panel at the World Economic Forum with the Minister of Justice in the US, John Ashcroft. He's known as the Attorney General. And, I mean, this guy is scary, right? I mean, he's worse than Bush, if you can imagine. And the topic was, how will the war on terrorism shape the future? And if you're a civil society person at the World Economic Forum, the other person on the thing was the Prime Minister of Malaysia, the President of Colombia, and the president of a right-wing think tank called the RAND Corporation, which does a lot of work for the CIA. So if you're a civil society person there, you're lucky if they bring you in the last 15 minutes, right? But in any case, there's two advantages, though. One is you've heard everybody else's arguments and you can respond. The other thing is you're usually the only person with any pigmentation on your face. And so people in the audience who are mainly white, business people, they feel embarrassed, you know, I mean, 90 minutes, and they think, hey, they forgot about this guy. So eventually when the moderator asks you to say something, you can almost feel the people are relieved that you don't have sat there for 90 minutes with the moderator forgetting about you. So anyway, I said a lot of things that I said about the war on terrorism that I said already, but basically said, you know, you can't say that the war on terrorism is supposed to defend our civilization and our culture and so on. And then in the process of so-called defending your culture, our way of life, right, you then start decimating all of the things that are there. Not respecting the rule of law, detaining people without trial, religious and profiling, invading people's privacy, and so on and so forth. And I say, then what exactly are you defending? And I said, basically what you are doing, you are saying to the men of terror, you are so powerful, I'm giving you a victory by saying, I recognize how powerful you are, I'm going to actually compromise on certain things that are fundamental to the democratic ethic that I'm supposed to uphold. So Ashcroft lost it big time with me. And <he's, laughs> the thing is, with the other people, at least he could say, and he didn't know the other people's names either, even though they were presidents of countries and so on. And they kept saying, President of Malaysia and Prime Minister of Colombia, which is actually the opposite way. In my case, and it just so happens, I happen to be sitting on the right, and he says to the moderator from the BBC, he says, I'm deeply perturbed by my panelists on the far right. And then it got into a bit of an exchange, and he said, I reduce everything to race. Right? And it's very important how the religious component is kept out of it. Right? That I reduce everything to race, and he was deeply perturbed by that, and I'm quoting now, because I believe that communities are more determined on the basis of values, not on the basis of race. For example, we in the United States have just celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday, and Martin Luther King said, people should be judged by the content of the character, not the color of the skin. Thank God for that incident that happened to me in Atlanta, because I was able to come back to him and say, sir, firstly, please accept my apology that I was so inarticulate that I led you to believe everything should be reduced to race. Coming from South Africa, I want to assure you that's not my position. Secondly, sir, I can guarantee you that when I got taken off a flight in Atlanta last year, it had nothing to do with the content of my character. And the whole place like kind of exploded and so on. But the implications, just to give you practically for me, the implications of that statement is that the hounding that I have going in and out of the US, my 15-year-old daughter is being monitored by them, because when I went in alone, every time I go in, they take my fingerprint, the photograph, and then they send me to a room for an interview. And then one time I went in after that incident, the gentleman asked me, the questions asked me, so who is Naomi Alexander? She has a mum's surname. I tell you, I freaked out. You know, I mean, just to think that you're, and at that time she was 12 years old. You know, and so what I'm saying is that the paranoia, right, and so on, is really undermining, and it's going to force more and more people. And what I'm worried about is when I travel in the Middle East, I can tell you I meet professors, women professors in their 50s, and the conversations I have with them is you know, it's understandable but shocking. You know, I mean, they say, what would you do if this is how you're being brutalized, this is how you, you know, particularly, you know, the whole situation in Palestine and so on. And I'd conclude by saying that, you know, the irony about terrorism, the way it's being defined now, if you look at who are the biggest sponsors of terrorism historically, who made Osama bin Laden? He was a construct of the CIA when he was an ally in Afghanistan fighting the on Mujahideen fighting the Russians. Saddam Hussein, who armed him with the initial chemical weapons? He was absolutely fine when he was bombing the Kurds and the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war. And yeah, I think you all need to challenge your government to be consistent in the way that they act on these issues. And I think when they overreact, they undermine the notion of the rule of law. And the last thing you want is for people, particularly from socially excluded groups and historically oppressed groups, to feel that they can't trust the law, because that's the worst outcome in terms of undermining democracy overall. Sorry, that was a bit of a verbal diarrhea there. But I mean, you can see, personally it affects me, you know, and also these guys that are in prison in Ethiopia. I mean, I'm dashing home now, just to give an example. I'm dashing home after this. I have a week at home, and this was not on my schedule. I thought, you know, long, difficult year of travel and work, I'll collapse in a heap as I normally do around this time, you know, just before Christmas. And our members in Pakistan have put huge pressure on me to actually now come to Pakistan. And so I'll spend five... But if you think about how a coup leader has been uncritically supported, right? So, I mean, you know, if you just take out the... Even if you take the New Zealand government, right, how it treats Pervez Musharraf, and how it treats the Fijian... I'm not wanting to back the Fijian position, but the inconsistency, right? You know, if you don't have to look too much to see the inconsistency. Sorry, let me clarify. 60 countries have passed specific laws restricting non-governmental organizations and civil society organizations, either passed or are in the process of trying to pass. We've managed through our campaigning to stop the one in Venezuela for now, and a few other countries. We failed in most cases. Right? But in terms of that question that you asked about counterterrorism legislation, most countries passed immediately after 9/11. Huge pressure from the UN and so on. And it was about money laundering and all of those things. A lot of countries have actually begun to review. And some countries have actually taken away some of the more pernicious elements already.